And now,
the definition.
President Trump has a new target. Stephen Colbert. He's calling the Late Night Post a no-talent guy whose show was dying until Colbert started attacking Trump. There's nothing funny about what he says, and what he says is filthy, and you have kids watching, Trump tells Time magazine.
The President of the United States has personally come after me and my show. And there's only one thing to say.
On last night's show, Colbert was positively gleeful about Trump's attack.
I've been trying for a year to get you to say my name. And you were very restrained, admirably restrained, but now you did it. I won. Oh, no!
Trump also slammed CNN hosts Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo. In the Time magazine interview, he calls Lemon perhaps the dumbest person in broadcasting and says Cuomo is like a chained lunatic.
Show. I'm your host, Stephen Colbert. It is day 102 of the Trump presidency, 1,358 days to go, but who's counting? Now, a little notch on my wall. Now, Trump has repeatedly said that this 100 days thing is totally arbitrary, okay? Totally unimportant. And to prove how unimportant it is, he took out a TV ad, he cut a cake on Air Force One, and he held a rally in Pennsylvania. The theme of that rally? Promises made, promises kept. Which is better than their original slogan, promises made, never mind, never said it, fake news, watch Fox and Friends. So, long, it's nice, it's got a rhythm. He also proved just how unimportant this was with a bunch of interviews over the weekend. First, on Friday, he talked with Reuters about his new job.
Well, I loved my previous life. I had so many things going. I actually, this is more work than in my previous life. I thought it would be easier.
How about that?
He thought it would be
How about easy. That? It turns out being leader of the free world is harder than licensing your name to luxury meat. Delicious. But that's not all. He trumped on.
I thought it was more of a, I'm a details-oriented person. I think you would say that. But I do miss my old life.
We all do, sir. I get why he misses it. I get it, man. Because in his old life, he could spend his days golfing, insulting people on Twitter, and hanging out with his family. Also, now. And that's not the only reason he's bummed. It's also because I can't drive anymore. And you know he drove all the time. He's a great driver. Yeah. I mean, just look how comfortable he is behind the wheel. That's exactly how you drive. Hands at 7 and 5, mouth open, screaming. Ah! Ah! Red light! Thanks, Obama!
Open road.
Of course, he addressed the proudest achievement of his presidency, it existing. Because in the middle of discussing Chinese-American relations with the Reuters reporters, he stopped to hand out copies of what he said were the latest figures from the 2016 electoral map, saying, pretty good, right? The red is obviously us. The blue, obviously Democrats, except when it's water. Hard to tell. Aquaman, personal friend. Great guy. There's probably. Probably. There's even a picture. I colored these myself. These are all placemats. I had them. Can you put that photo back up? Can I see that again? This is my impression of a T-Rex. Little hands, like this, like this. What? Everything's in here. I'm proud to say that the official defining 100 Days interview took place right here on CBS with the nation face himself, John Dickerson, yesterday. And he started off with North Korea.
Mr. President, you and the administration said to North Korea, don't test a missile. They have tested a missile. Is the pressure not working?
Well, I didn't say don't test a missile. He's going to have to do what he has to do.
So our official policy is you do you. What can I say? Hitler gonna Hitler. Kim Jong gonna un. Then, and that's not this, out of this. Then our friend John Dickerson asked Trump what he thought of Kim Jong Un.
I can tell you this, and a lot of people don't like when I say it, but he was a young man of 26 or 27 when he took over from his father. A lot of people, I'm sure, tried to take that power away, whether it was his uncle or anybody else. And he was able to do it. So obviously, he's a pretty smart cookie.
So, Trump thinks Kim Jong-un is a smart cookie, to which all of North Korea replied, cookie? He's a monster. The point is, he's a monster. Fat little monster. Now, Dickerson gamely tried to get Trump to commit to releasing his tax returns finally, but it was the same old song and dance about under audit. So, I'd like to rephrase the question. Mr. President, can you talk about your tax returns as a metaphor for your penis?
I have a very big tax return. You've seen the pictures. My tax return is probably higher than that from the floor. When you look at other people's tax return, even other wealthy people, their tax return is this thick. My tax return is this high.
We get it. You have a huge tax return. But you know what would be nice? A full release. Later. So I've heard. I wouldn't know. I'm flattered, but I'm not into that scene. Later in the same interview, Trump gave Dickerson a tour of the Oval Office.
This is the Resolute desk. It's a great desk with a phenomenal history. This was FDR, it was Ronald Reagan, it was Kennedy. There's some great presidents behind this desk.
Yes, and if you put your ear to it like a seashell, you can hear all of them rolling in their graves. And President Trump. And President Trump explained that visitors are awed by the power of the Oval Office.
In one case, I won't say who, somebody you know very well, the head of a major, major company. The person came into the Oval Office and started to cry. This is a tough person, by the way. Came into the Oval Office and started to cry.
Mr. President, if I came to the Oval Office and saw you sitting behind the desk, I'd cry too. Now, there was a nice moment when John Dickerson talked about some previous president's thoughts with Trump, other men who have stood in that room and their thoughts about the responsibilities of the presidency. But I'm not quite sure that Donald Trump understood the message.
George W. Bush said the reason the Oval Office is round is there are no corners you can hide in.
Well, there's truth to that. There is truth to that. There are certainly no corners.
That's what he meant.
Okay. Let's be positive. At least he knows his shapes. He knows oval. Okay. He knows the Pentagon and rhombus because it's Reince Priebus' middle name. Reince Rhombus Priebus. And on the subject of previous presidents, Dickerson asked Trump if he still stands by claims that President Obama wiretapped him.
You stand by that claim about him?
I don't stand by anything.
It's true. He doesn't stand by anything except the dressing room door at Miss USA pageant. But hiya! Boo! Who needs some lotion? But, based on a true story of that joke, but Dickerson asked his question anyway.
But I'm asking you, because you don't want it to be fake news. I want to hear it from President Trump.
Me. You don't have to ask me.
Why not?
Because I have my own opinions. You can have your own opinions.
But I want to know your opinions. You're the President of the United States.
It's enough. Thank you. Thank you very much.
can't talk anymore. No, can't talk anymore. Important presidency work here. Got a president all over these papers here. Let's see, what's this? Yep, still paper, still blank paper, nothing on there. Let's see, let me read this presidential briefing. Yep, I got the president, I got the briefing right here. I got the briefing, yes, it's true. We gotta do something. Yes, oh, yeah. Sorry, John, can't talk. Gotta do something, gotta do something about the nation of Charministan. Sorry about that. We must wipe them off the map, uh-huh. Is Dickerson still over there? I don't want to look. Is he still there? Bring. Sorry, hello, yes. Got it, it's very secure phone. Yes, this is Donald Trump. John, I gotta take this call. It's the president of Asia calling. Hello, really important. John, I can't hear you. I've got a banana in my ear. Obviously, I'm joking. Something was on that paper, all right? Do we have a reverse shot, Jim? Yeah, there you go. But I gotta say, walking out in the middle of a sentence wasn't even the president's biggest insult to John Dickerson.
And I think actually I've been very consistent. You know, it's very funny when the fake media goes out, you know, which we call the mainstream media, which sometimes I must say is you. But when the
you
fake
mean me personally or
your show. I love your show. I call it Deface the Nation.
Really? Whoa. Donald Trump, John Dickerson is a fair-minded journalist and one of the most competent people who will ever walk into your office, and you treat him like that? Now, John Dickerson has way too much dignity to trade insults with the President of the United States to his face. But I, sir, am no John Dickerson. And when you, okay? All right? Let me introduce you to something we call the Tiffany way. When you insult one member of the CBS family, you insult us all. Bazinga. All right? Here we go. All right?
Oh, get the gloves off.
Mr. Trump, your presidency, I love your presidency. I call it Disgrace the Nation. You're not the POTUS. You're the bloatus. You're the glutton with the button. You're a regular gorge Washington. You're the presidents, but you're turning into a real pricktator. Sir, you attract more skinheads than free Rogaine. You have more people marching against you than cancer. You talk like a sign language gorilla who got hit in the head. In fact, the only thing your mouth is good for is being Vladimir Putin's holster. Your presidential library. Your presidential library is going to be a kid's menu and a couple of Jugs magazine. The only thing smaller than your hands is your tax returns. And you can take that any way you want. We got a great show for you tonight.
I'm Keith Olbermann, and this is The Resistance. In the span of one weekend, a man who essentially usurped the office of President of the United States with the assistance of this nation's most powerful and venomous enemy has himself attacked the structure of our Senate and our House of Representatives because their rules are archaic and they inconvenience him, has himself dismissed the two-party system because he believes it is obstructionist, has himself attacked the constitutionally protected freedom of the press because the media has repeatedly caught him lying, has himself let his chief of staff confirm he may try to eradicate those freedoms of speech and your freedoms of speech. In sum, this man has himself so endangered the freedoms and the liberties of this country that if anyone does not understand that they and you and I and every individual in this country and everything we love and everything for which every American soldier has ever fought, all of it is under attack right now by this crypto-fascist Trump, if they do not see that their freedoms hang by a thread, they are sheep headed to the slaughter or collaborators leading the rest of us there for the sake of Trump. The failing New York Times has disgraced the media world. John Carl of ABC said that as he read Trump's tweet from March 30th aloud. Gotten me wrong for two solid years. Change the libel laws? To Trump's chief of staff, Reince Priebus, Mr. Carl continued, that would require, as I understand it, a constitutional amendment. Is he really going to pursue that? Is that something he wants to pursue?
And Priebus answered, I think it's something that we've looked at. And how that gets executed or whether that goes anywhere is a different story. But when you have articles out there that have no basis or fact, and we're sitting here on 24/7 cable companies writing stories about constant contacts with Russia and all these other matters that have no basis at all... Here Mr. Carl interrupted to refocus Priebus on whether or not Trump should be able to sue the New York Times. Priebus, quote, and I already answered the question. I said this is something that is being looked at. Wrong goddamned answer. The correct answer is that freedom of speech is the purpose of the United States of America. And every time this country's government has tried to alter that fact or has ignored it in the slightest, it has met with disaster. The correct answer is that constitutional change to limit free speech would not just be a step on a slippery slope, but it would be putting the entire nation in an 18-wheeler and driving at full speed down that slippery slope. The correct answer is never, never! Do not be sidetracked by Priebus' milquetoast disclaimer about whether that goes anywhere. Do not be reassured that at its worst, this so-called government would only attack the news media. Do not settle down because a constitutional amendment is the longest of long shots. This is about the threat, about the chilling effect, as much as it is about the execution. Priebus started by saying it's something that we've looked at, and then he upgraded his threat to the present tense by saying this is something that is being looked at for the sake of Trump. If, as Trump first suggested more than 14 months ago, quote, we're going to open up those libel laws, it would not be the New York Times or ABC News that would be the victims, it would be you. The New York Times and ABC News and the like could, even in those nightmare scenarios, be able to defend themselves legally at least for a time. Would you? If the libel laws were opened up, if writing or publishing a story the government found was merely inaccurate now subjected the writer or publisher to a libel lawsuit with financial damages or worse, exactly who would then be a writer or a publisher? Would writing a blog post be writing or publishing? Would sending a tweet be writing or publishing? Would speaking at a protest be writing or publishing? Armed with changed libel laws, Trump's target would be you. What he would stop would not be a newspaper article or a cable news story that his supporters would never read nor see nor believe even if they were forced to look at it. What he would stop would be dissent. What he would create, what his attacks on the media on Twitter and at that white nationalist circle jerk in Pennsylvania Saturday night, what that little rat Priebus is getting at, is invoking fear inside you. A hesitation before you protested or spoke out or wrote or tweeted or posted a comment online, that moment in which you ask yourself, is this going to get me sued? This technique has worked for Trump all of his life. Family members, ex-wives, business contacts, customers, the suckers of Trump University, lawsuit after lawsuit, the blight of financial ruin if you violated his non-disclosure clauses. This is how Trump has gotten away with nearly every crooked deal and every broken contract and every threat to the middle wife that nobody talks about anymore, because if she says anything, she and her Trump child could get cut off or sued. That's what Trump and his minions like Priebus want for this country. Before you criticize, even if every fact is on your side, they want an America in which a voice inside your head screams, remember, the government could sue you for libel and keep you in court with lawyers for years indefinitely, and even if you prevail, the government could ruin your life, erase your savings, destroy your family, and that's if you win. And as you envision that nightmare, something else not to be missed in the snarling little throwaway comment by Trump's toady Mr. Priebus. What was the first example he gave of what kind of free speech needs to be erased, you know, for the sake of Trump? Which topic just happened to come up when phrases like change libel laws and constitutional amendment were invoked? The first story to which the Trump brand of fascism turns, the first story about which they want to criminalize dissent, is the Trump connection to the Russians. And that just happens to come up as Trump invites the murderous strongman of the Philippines, this pig Duterte, to the White House. Duterte, who said last year, quote, "Just because you're a journalist, you are not exempted from assassination if you're a son of a bitch," unquote. It's all coincidence, no doubt. "You look at the rules of the Senate, even the rules of the House," Trump said on Fox on Saturday. "It's really a bad thing for the country, in my opinion. They're archaic rules. And maybe at some point we're going to have to take those rules on, because for the good of the nation, things are going to have to be different. You can't, through a process like this, it's not fair. It forces you to make bad decisions. And now we change the rules of the House and the Senate because they don't move fast enough. For the sake of Trump, because the bureaucratic delay built into our system by the founding fathers to prevent despots or foreigners from changing our way of life overnight is keeping Trump from changing our way of life overnight. Oh, and that two-party system, the right of the opposition to exist, that too has to be changed for the sake of Trump. I also learned, and this is very sad because we have a country that we have to take care of," he said on CBS. "The Democrats have been totally obstructionist. Chuck Schumer has turned out to be a bad leader. He's a bad leader for the country. And the Democrats are extremely obstructionist. All they do is obstruct. And you know what that's hurting? It's hurting the country. Change the House and Senate rules for the sake of Trump. Get rid of the rights of the Senate minority, even if they represent the rights of the majority of the voters in the last election, for the sake of Trump. Instill the fear that to speak or write or tweet or ask, 'What is this with Russia?' will get you sued for libel for the sake of Trump. This man already, as of 102 days in office, the worst president in the history of the United States, already the symbol of betrayal and apparent treachery and the willingness to whore himself out to whichever foreign nation will give him a win in the media or a win at the ballot box. This pitiful excuse for a human being is a thug bent on destroying the freedoms of this country as we know them, and God damn it, we are not going to let him do it. Resist. Peace."
"What's all this about?"
"I'm celebrating."
"Celebrating what?"
"I think this could be the best show you've ever done."
"Very good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Listen, we've got an extraordinary show for you tonight. You're not going to believe it. As a matter of fact, I don't think I do. Would you please give a very warm welcome to our own Chancellor, Adam Sutler?"
No.
"We threw out the censor-approved script and shot a new one that I wrote this morning."
"Oh, my God.
Chancellor, 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 I understand you've been under tremendous strain lately since the beginning of this whole terrorism business, and we thought it would be a nice idea to try and help you relax. Go." "Ah, warm milk. There's nothing better."
"I understand you enjoy a glass every night, Chancellor."
"Since I was a boy."
"Hmm.
But you're wrong, Mr. Dietrich. The terrorist was never a serious concern."
"Oh, really?" "Chancellor, Chancellor..."
"Tim!"
"Are you saying that he's not still alive and active?"
"Terrorist has been neutralized."
"Oh, my God! Chancellor! The terrorist! The terrorist! Get him!"
"Oh, dear!"
To shoot the
street liar,
faker,
fraud,
ready,
aim,
fire!
Well, what are they going to do?
Fine us? Big deal. We've got the most watched show on air.
Well, you're my agent. That's what I pay you for.
Protect me. Should have hired him years ago to be my mother.
You're mad.
Either that or I wasn't breastfed.
Is everything a joke to you, Gordon?
Only the things that matter.
What if they come after you?
Listen, I tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to have to make some kind of apology, do some boring fundraiser, and in the meantime, our ratings will go through the roof. It'll be fine. Trust me.
Gordon?
Quickly, hide!
Not so funny now, is it, funny man?
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Vimeer Deese. Welcome to a all new episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Had to take a little bit of a break. I like to say that the world was getting a little too real, but you know, you need some time away from things for a while. And as I mentioned before, I'm starting to work on this other podcast, which is going to require a significant amount of time because it's one of the few that I hear that is going to be thought out. I mean, it's going to be, almost every inch of it is going to be thought out, even to the extent of interviews, which I hope to definitely conduct someday using the podcast as a format. Now, with that being said, I also mentioned that it was likely that this podcast was going to undergo a change or else it was going to be scrapped altogether. I remember when I first started this little podcast, I was going to call it Observations from the Class War Battlefield. And the primary reason I was going to call it that was because I grew up in a community which was devastated by the modern economic conditions which this country finds itself mired in. 4 or 5 decades ago, the community I lived in was kind of the central hub. I guess it wouldn't be considered the central hub, but it was definitely a kind of a suburb, a country suburb for two very large communities, two very large cities, and the suburbs that were springing up around them. When people really wanted to go to the country, they would come to the place where I lived, which was in the country, but it had the feel of a suburb. So it was really nice.
And there were a number of jobs in that community and the couple of communities that were around it, which kept people well fed and kept them well employed, and they made decent money. So it was really a prosperous time. Now, I need to always say this, that I grew up in a very white town. It was predominantly white, and the Italians had a lot of sway in the community and in the area which I grew up in. This is very important because, and this is something that I had to learn, but when you put Italians and blacks kind of together, it usually doesn't end well. Italians do not, for some reason, like black people that much. Not saying all Italians, but it's a common theme. And this existed in the community and in the area in which I lived. Now, this is important also because that tells you who had the economic might. The Italians, the Germans, the Poles, the Europeans had the economic might. Black people lived in the area, and some of them even had some economic prowess, but still, they had to acquiesce to the white people who they were around. The majority of black people, brown people, were migrants or impoverished. They didn't have really sound footing in the communities which I grew up in. This is seen by way of the fact that most of the black people in the area that I grew up in are well known for sports. And if they wanted to make something of themselves, they had to leave. They couldn't stay in the community to really climb up the ladder and to do great things. Not to say people don't. I know a couple of people, right offhand actually, that did decently well for themselves, but they are still bit players in the politics of everything in the community. Fast forwarding though. As I was growing up, the jobs were dwindling away. When I was a child, 8, 9 years old, there were several factories and warehouses and businesses that really helped move the economy. And as they left, one by one by one, the economy and the town headed south quick. It went downhill. And so I started noticing, particularly when I went to college in my mid-20s, the cultural, social, and geographical impacts of these companies leaving. And thus, I decided to do something about it. Get involved politically? No. That wasn't even in my mind. But documented. And hence was born Observations of the Class War Battlefield. And then, literally, as I've stated before, a couple of weeks before Occupy Wall Street blew up, I decided that I was going to turn this into a podcast. And my first instinct was Observation of the Class War Battlefield. But that didn't roll off the tongue, so I cut off the observation of the, and then just left Class War Battlefield, and then added podcast. Point is this. When I imagined this podcast, I didn't have any format. I didn't have any line of communication. It was just going to be a free-for-all. It was going to be free-form. Anyone who's listened to it, though, particularly my early shows from 2012, particularly, you would note that I started kind of forming some basis behind the show. I would use clips from YouTube, music from YouTube, combined with clips from audiobooks and documentaries and other podcasts to form some kind of a theme. I want to continue this, but I want to make it, if I'm going to actually continue using this podcast, I want to make it not only more streamlined, but I also want to make it more accessible to you. I also want to utilize the talents of people to form a podcast that is, it seems scripted, because it is scripted, but it's also not just scripted, it delves deeply into the psyche, so a person can have, it's almost, I'll put it this way, I'd like to have it almost come off like an audiobook. So each episode, or each couple of episodes, will be almost a documentary audiobook where you can learn things and experience well thought out thoughts, if I might. And so that's really where I'm looking to take this. And it's going to take some time over the next, you know, few months, maybe even a year, to really get the format down. But going forward, this is what I'm going to seek to do with this podcast. Now, for the time being, it ain't going to be that. It's going to be what it's typically been. So, you know, just hang in there. But know this, in the future, this autumn, this coming up winter, maybe even the beginning of next spring, Class War Battlefield is going to shift back to doing what I used to do, which is episode 1, episode 2, episode 3, episode 4. Probably going to do groups, though. And I'm going to put together interviews and what have you, focused on that format which I was talking to you about. I want people to view this as one of the highest formatted, you know, podcasts. I respect some of the podcasts that I listen to because they are so structured. And since we are in an age, which really we've been in an age since 2000, where structure is sorely needed when it comes to information and thought. Now, unfortunately, to do this, it's likely I might have to reach into my pocket or maybe do some crowdfunding, because some of the people who I'd like to really participate in this new form, it's probably going to cost me a couple $100 or maybe even $1,000 or $2,000 to have their input in the way that I'd like to have it. But, you know, I may be coming to you sometime in the future for that. Or maybe not, you know, depending. But we'll get into more of that later. But on to the show. Man, there's so much going on. There's so much that has gone on. What can really be said? Man. Let's do this. The United States is currently, which I don't know how much media coverage this has gotten, but I saw it on Mint Press News, but they're currently conducting military exercises outside of Venezuela or off the coast of Venezuela. And can you say proxy war? you know, I said it before that I feel this whole Russia baiting thing is aimed at trying to immunize the public from what is perceived by the elite to be a social left turn in the coming decade. I'm already hearing rumblings from conservatives, particularly on social media, pointing to the horribleness or the horrible condition Venezuela finds itself in. as a rebuke to socialism or anything that seeks to prop up the commonwealth against this rabid, sickening ideology of individualist capitalism. And I find myself, you know, showing restraint to them now, because nothing I say, nothing I could do is going to change their minds. But when I did used to argue with them, what I would tell them is this. Socialism has gotten a bad rap because of the USSR, which was not socialist altogether. It was authoritarian and it was totalitarian. You cannot be a socialistic country and be authoritarian. That is just point blank, period. You can't do it. Well, the USSR did exactly that. So did Saddam Hussein. Yes, they claimed socialism, but a lot of people claim a lot of things that ain't true. Great example. This country, United States of America, likes to say it is rooted in a history of property rights. Okay, let's talk to Native Indigenous Americans about property rights. This country likes to say that it is rooted in a history of freedom. How about we talk to Afro-Americans, Black Americans, about what freedom has meant to them for this country? Like I said, countries can claim a lot of things. Don't mean that that is actually what they uphold. You can slap the name socialism on anything. Doesn't mean it's actually socialistic. As a very good Black scholar said, socialism originates not in Marx's head. No. Marx was a historian. He was also a philosopher. He was not a politician. The man was dramatically smart. Socialism starts with those societies which European minds, I was going to say European American minds, but it's really European accusation, I guess. But European minds say these are primitive societies. You can trace socialism in its form back to Africa, back to some peoples in Asia, even peoples in Europe who were overrun by the Anglos and other war-hungry tribes. Socialism, which the Native Americans, the Native Indigenous Americans, showcased brilliantly when they came up against the starving European, quote, settlers, taking care of them. We know how that ended. Socialism binds the one to the collective and the collective to the one. Now, must be noted that there was room for improvement to these types of socialism. It kind of stymied innovation, so they weren't ready to push ahead and develop innovatively when they came across the group of people who were rabidly dead set on mechanization and conquering. That's the only tweak that it needed. It needed to increase and involve more innovation. But that's not a dramatic tweak. Socialism is truthfully the only answer. Now, I gave up socialism a few years ago. I promised the late Michael Rupert that I felt socialism, you know, wasn't going to help the United States out of its problems. And I felt that way because I was listening to what he had said and what some other folks kind of in his little circle said about socialism. And predominantly, if memory serves me correctly, it came down to it's been tried, it's over. Well, no, it actually, socialism has, whenever it has really been tried, the United States and the European powers have went in to disrupt it and to take it down. Why? Not because it was going to hurt the people, but because it was going to help the people. Capitalism is by its very nature a white supremacy organ. It is based on white supremacy. It is based on the dominance of Europe. And now, increasingly, it's shifting its focus to Asia, which is terribly frightening because I don't know much about China, Chinese history, but I know this. They have some very vicious emperors and dictators. They have a very rigid and structured society, and if that starts to be exported throughout the world, boy, it's not going to be good for the people who are looking to them for freedom. Capitalism is not a freedom-creating enterprise. It is a freedom-exploiting enterprise. It tells you you are free, but only if you pledge to commit your resources, your blood, your sweat, your offspring, all to realizing profit for its perpetuation. That's what capitalism is. Pure and simple. That's what it is. Capitalism by itself facilitates fascism. It facilitates authoritarianism. It facilitates dictatorial enterprises. Because in and of itself, it creates miniature dictatorships. That's called the corporation. You have a hierarchy which leads to one or two people at the top. And guess what? What they say goes. That's dictatorship. If you have an economic instrument, an economic plan which works like that, the social culture surrounding it will have to work like that. Kind of shocking, isn't it? But it's the truth. It is the truth. Socialism is the fear by the elite, not because it won't work. It is the fear by the elite because they see in this new generation, the millennials that they keep talking about, a need and a drive towards community. Localization is the key word. Notice, over the past 5 years, how localization and there's another word that I'm forgetting about. There's another phrase that they use where you source everything from local markets and local businesses and what have you. This has become standard operation now, even for big business. Notice how they have changed a lot of the recipes that they are putting out, even though, I must say, writing on the label other natural, ingredients or other non-artificial ingredients, it doesn't bode well. It still smacks and reeks of chemicals to me, but that's, I guess, another thing. But they are trying to maneuver themselves to this quickly evolving mindset within this new group, which is larger than the baby boomers, which is saying and stating unequivocally that we want community, we want something better than our parents had, and we see, even though many of them will not come out and say this, we see it as socially unreliable to continue the way you have trotted. We can't do that anymore. And this is why they are trying desperately over these last few years to reinvigorate the capitalist spirit by saying, well, we hear you and we're changing. We hear you and we're changing. The fact of the matter is, they ain't gonna change. That's not who they are. That's not in their DNA. Corporations are cancer cells. They live for one reason, to extract minerals and resources and turn them into waste and product. Waste and product. Waste and product. If capitalism, truthfully, if capitalism had the potential to be a more equal and caring and compassionate system, there is one time in the history of the United States when it would have emerged as such, and that is directly after World War II. I say this simply for one reason. After World War II, or excuse me, during World War II, while everything was being marshaled in for victory overseas, capitalism was demanding that people recycle as much as possible. I'm talking recycling everything they could recycle and rationing everything they could ration. If capitalism was capable of being compassionate, it would have taken that drive to ration and recycle and reuse and repurpose all of that stuff for war. It would have turned it around and said, now we will harness all of our innovative ability, all of our skill to recycle and reuse all the stuff that we are creating now continuously. We'll just reuse it and reuse it and recycle it. Every community, that's what we'll do. We'll create millions of jobs doing nothing but that. That is what the last 80 years, well, 70 years, would have been built on. But no. What did capitalism do? Now, of course, people are going to say, oh, capitalism, you keep saying capitalism. It's people. People driven by an ideological format. And that format is the genetic code within capitalism. It may have been created by people, but after a while, when you adhere to something so much, it becomes a force of its own. So that people who step into it, people who endeavor to carry it on, they become merely a pawn. Not even a pawn. I won't even say a pawn. They become a player. I won't even say player. They just become a perpetuator of that energy. There you go. A perpetuator of that energy. What capitalism did after marshaling all of those resources to war was it restructured itself as a war economy and war machine. Why? Because it is incapable of building a commonwealth mission. It's not built for that. Capitalism was built for empire. It was built for imperialism. It was built for conquering and conquest. It was built for subjugation. There has to be haves, and there has to be have-nots, and there has to be have-nothings. Now, of course, people say, well, wait a minute, have-nots and have-nothings are the same thing. Really? I don't consider have-nots and have-nothings the same thing. Have-nots, yeah, they ain't got much of nothing, but they got a little something. They ain't got all that money, but they may have, you know, bed, a house. They may be able to do something with it, but you have nothings. Go to some of these, quote, third world countries. You want to see some have nothings? Whew. Oh, man. You have the haves, the have-nots, and the have-nothings. And that's what capitalism requires. Because ultimately, as I've said before, I've said it over and over again, and I know some of you probably get sick of hearing me say it, but it is necessary, especially today. Capitalism has, it came from imperialism, it came from mercantilism, it combined all of that. And that's where we're at today. This now brings me to Mr. Trump's attack on the First Amendment, particularly going after Steve Colbert for his hilarious joke. Yeah, that if by the way you haven't seen that that monologue, it's incredible. I'll probably put it at the beginning of the show, but this is dangerous. The FCC is entertaining the complaints of individuals who found what Mr. Colbert said offensive. I gotta tell you, it's insane. You know, people, I think they miss the reality of this. If, Keith Olbermann actually made a statement a couple of weeks ago on the First Amendment, on the quote, opening up of the libel laws, which Priebus talked about in an interview. And he said, look, when the country starts stepping on the First Amendment, it's a slippery slope. He also said that what Donald Trump wants, and this is not hard to really deduce, is that people will start thinking in their minds, well, I don't want to write this, I don't want to say this, or else I might get sued, I might go to jail, whatever. This monologue and the response could not have been more timely. I'm not joking when I say Olbermann released that comment a couple of weeks ago. I don't even know if it was exactly 2 weeks ago. It might have been slightly under. And then this occurred. If a guy like Steve Colbert can be made into investigative cannon fodder, basically. What is that telling you that these people are preparing in their minds for individuals not as large as him? I mean, honest to God, I'll tell you what it reminded me of. If you've ever seen V for Vendetta, if you've ever seen the movie V for Vendetta, that's what this reminded me of. My mind took a trip into the future. 10 years, let's say. Lord knows, hopefully this never comes true. But 10 years into the future, there's a Steve Colbert-like person. Maybe it's Steve Colbert. There's a new Donald Trump in office. But this one actually has some real dictatorial power. The society has just crumbled that much. Now, mind you, some of you may think, oh, that's a little bit amazing, that's a little bit incredible, but come on, man, things are going to pick itself up. We said that after George W. Bush, didn't we? Things have not gotten better. So the economy's in the toilet now. You have a president who's Donald Trump, but with common sense. And you have a military that is somewhat out of control. And maybe even kind of participating. So now you have somebody like Steve Colbert make a joke like that. It is leaked that there's going to be an investigation. that the person is likely getting in trouble. Maybe even he does get in trouble. Maybe even he gets fired. Because the head of the television network is friends with the president. So he gets fired. Boom, gone. And then there's stories of him being assaulted by rabid presidential supporters, or even worse, oath keepers, or even worse, officers of the law who think it's their duty to protect the law from people like him. Now, if you really don't believe that can happen in this country, now you may think, oh, you're scaremongering, man, come on. Ladies and gentlemen, most of us forget that when the 1 year passed for Michael Brown's death, there were armed militiamen walking through the streets of nonviolent protesters. This is where the country is. This concerns me. Like I said, it reminds me immediately when I heard about it, it reminded me of that scene from V for Vendetta. This needs to be stressed. I'm hoping things don't get worse, but I also know that many people are not willing to look at the causes of all of this. For far too long, there has been two societies. Dr. King talked about it. Unfortunately, and I mean this sincerely, he didn't really have enough time to develop that idea of the other America, because it's a powerful concept. But there has been two societies. One society has all the privileges, and I use that word deliberately, has all the privileges, has all the rights, has all the ability to make real their visions and dreams, while the other half, the other side, does not. Now, you would think, as I'm talking, that I'm just talking about black people. I'm not. I'm talking about black and brown and red people, yes. But, to a lesser extent, even to poor, poor, poor white people, or European Americans, as I increasingly call them, because they ain't white. They need to get over that. They ain't white. Maybe one of the new episodes that I'll be doing is actually on that history of whiteness, because they ain't white. They ain't. Sucks for them, but they ain't. So, these two Americas, the one with all of the privileges, sought to keep the other one out of their mind, out of the consciousness of the privileged ones. And guess what? That didn't happen. Like trying to contain cancer in multiple areas of the body, it's going to spread. And that's exactly what's happened. Oh. It's tragic. It really is. Finally, on what may be, I think, maybe a little positive note. Seeing how we just passed the 100-day marker of Mr. Trump's election. Okay, this ain't going to be good news either. This will not be good news. Brad Friedman was just talking about on his show this past week the diabolical scheme employed by several states to disenfranchise people, taking away their right to vote, basically. And I want you all to understand what time it is. You know, this is a time for us to find again our revolutionary fervor, because it's going to be needed. You know, these people are not playing to win for 2 or 3 years. They're playing to hold you hostage for the next 2 or 3 decades. Which is why what's his name was placed on the court, the Supreme Court. They are setting it up to hold you hostage. And the question becomes why. The question becomes why. The country is in debt. It is likely not going to get out of debt. It is likely that the elite are saying, to hell with it. We're not paying this debt. They are presently moving forward with allowing many countries to invest billions of dollars. I can't understate this enough. Billions of dollars in your country. They are allowing the Chinese to purchase properties throughout this country. They have hundreds of billions of dollars that they are sinking into this country. And the elite are doing nothing to stymie it. Now, I want you to think about this, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to really honestly think about this, because it should be concerning to you. These people will let the Chinese government, a communist entity, come in and purchase properties, businesses, what have you, right from under you. They will let them come in and literally purchase the waters out of the Great Lakes. That was stopped, I think, a couple of years back, though. So, but they will let them come in and purchase your country. And yet, if you were to organize, you yourself were to organize your neighbors, your community, your region, pooling your money together to try to do the same thing, you might find yourself in a judicial limbo for the foreseeable future. They would prefer to have an authoritarian government own your property, own your country, than to have you own it. What does that say about their mentality? I'm not joking. This should frighten the hell out of you. And by frighten, I don't mean immobilize you. But it should frighten you to wake up. They are selling you out to dictators, while at the same time, they are slandering anybody who's standing up and saying, we need socialism. We need a more communal economic system. Not communism, but we need an economic system that's at least going to protect what each community has and provide some leadership so the communities can work together. Because right now, capitalism isn't providing that. What is funny is, I think his name is Chairman Ma. He owns Alibaba. Very prosperous company. He laughed at us. He told the United States, you are insane with how you are conducting your economic policies. How can you do your economic policies like that and expect your communities to prosper? There was a story I caught the other day, and in fact, I give Gerald Horn credit for this because he mentioned it, and I mentioned it in an earlier podcast. The story was of this. Chinese billionaires are buying up, snatching up Hollywood production studios and such. And it is now believed, the story I was just reading, that because Hollywood is a financially driven entity, you and I are going to likely see things that benefit the Chinese Communist government, that benefit their business interests. The irony is this. The United States did the same thing to Britain after World War II. Basically, they were able to call the shots over Britain because they owned so much of Britain's debt. And they owned so much of Britain's, if you can call it, industry. I mean, after World War II, they had significant damage over there. But the United States could almost call the tune for them. They didn't call it too loud because, you know, Britain is basically their parent. But what of the United States and China? The fastest growing population in California is Asian descent. Chinese is significant there. And yet, the threat that people are most afraid of is the Latinos. The Latinos don't have the economic firepower behind them. The Chinese do. We might want to wake up and do it rapidly, because while we have been fighting, really, I kind of step out of that because it ain't my fight. But why do European Americans been fighting? Conservative, liberal. The people who you actually should have been fighting have been preparing to sell your country out from right underneath you. And you've been fighting for their loyalty. Amazing, amazing, amazing. You might want to wake up. I want to thank you for listening. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, if you just like to yell at me, if you think that, you know, I'm foolish, that I need to shut up my big mouth, that there is something wrong with me, as one of my conservative friends told me, or if you want to offer a word of support, as a good friend of mine recently did, drop me a line. Honestly, drop me a line. And let me also say this. If you have an amazing voice, you can read well, maybe even you can research well, also drop me a line. I'll keep you in mind as I start moving towards doing more scripted episodes. And the sound of the crowd in my ear. We can... maybe we can collab, we can work together. Alright? Peace, family, peace, ladies and gentlemen. Much love to you. I'll see you next time. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run. On the radio talk shows and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.